On To The Point, we try to make sense of the policy debates and the political sideshows on the campaign trail.
You have this kind of asymmetrical warfare coming from a guy who's great at a soundbite, lousy at an answer.
So are you looking for your own billionaire?
Nope. No, I don't want my own billionaire. I'm going to raise the vast majority of the money.
Brace yourself, America, for what?
King Trump.
I'm Warren Olney. To The Point has you covered for the 2016 campaign. Find the To The Point podcast on KCRW's iTunes page.
From KCRW and KCRW.com, this is Left, Right, and Center.
You like potato?
And you like potato?
You like tomato?
And you like tomato?
Potato?
Potato?
Tomato?
Tomato?
Let's call a potato.
Hillary Clinton went for the kill on Donald Trump in a speech arguing he could start multiple nuclear wars. Trump said the judge in his fraud trial is too Mexican to judge him, even though he's from Indiana, and Paul Ryan endorsed Donald Trump. It was quite a week. Welcome to Left, Right, and Center, your civilized yet provocative antidote to the self-contained opinion bubbles that dominate political debate. I'm Josh Barrow, senior editor at Business Insider. On the left is Robert Scheer, editor-in-chief at TruthDig.com and host of KCRW's podcast, Scheer Intelligence. On the right is Rich Lowry, editor of National Review, and our special guest is Joan Walsh, national affairs correspondent at The Nation magazine and MSNBC analyst. Welcome to you all. So this Hillary speech was really a greatest hits compilation of the most extreme things Donald Trump has said about foreign relations, that he would kill the families of suspected terrorists, that a war between Japan and North Korea would be okay, that he gives Vladimir Putin an A for leadership, et cetera, et cetera. The speech also laid out her foreign policy vision, which is probably a tick or two to the right of President Obama, but mostly incorporates fairly establishment ideas favored by politicians on both sides of the aisle, like that we should stay in NATO and work with allies to fight ISIS. Rich, I saw some pretty favorable reaction to this speech from some conservative writers like John Podoritz and Jennifer Rubin. Did you like the speech?
Well, it's kind of a low bar, but I think it's the most forceful and effective speech I can ever remember Hillary giving. I mean, she really owned this material, seemed quite sincere, and delivered it very forcefully. Now, it's a little bit of a misnomer to call it a foreign policy speech. You know, it was more an attack on Donald Trump and less about laying out her vision, which to the extent the vision was there, it's basically a very broad expression of kind of a mid-20th century liberal internationalism that is kind of the basis of bipartisan agreement on foreign policy on things like NATO and the importance of allies. But it was a blistering speech. It was what's most memorable and important about it is the attack on Donald Trump's temperament. And if Hillary Clinton beats him, this will be a big part of her case.
Joan, I kind of feel like this is, you know, Hillary, about a month ago, the campaign had floated this dangerous Donald thing that people made fun of, like, oh, you're going to sound silly giving him a nickname like that. But I feel like this was the fleshing out of what seems like her strongest argument, which is basically that this guy is too unpredictable, too risky. Who the hell knows what he might do? You have to elect me because I'm not him.
Exactly. I mean, the search for nicknames just seems stupid to me, but she really did pull together all in one place a compendium of his completely insane and dangerous ideas. And it also, you know, her tone was what I think won people over, as well as the content, that she seemed really comfortable with it, that she had a sense of humor, that, you know, occasionally it was kind of like roast style jokes with appropriate crowd laughter. But, you know, I think she really had the crowd. And it came at a really important time for two reasons. I mean, Senator Sanders seems to have surged in California, and the storyline before that speech yesterday was like, oh my God, more bedwetting. What is she going to do? And also, it came on the heels of, I think, the media beginning to turn on Trump somewhat after that ridiculous speech about the veterans and the, you know, really attacking the media for simply doing its job. So I think it was perfectly timed speech as well.
Yeah, Bob, one interesting thing about this speech was that it didn't seem to have a ton to offer the left. I mean, for example, she hit Trump for saying he'd be a neutral arbiter between Israel and the Palestinians. And I think the proposition she was offering people to her left was similar to the one she was offering people to her right, which is basically, what are you going to go with this guy? I'm your option.
Well, clearly, if Sanders does not succeed in California and does not stop Hillary, and there is no progressive leverage, she will move sharply to the right. She is a neoconservative in foreign policy. It kind of reminded me a little bit of the baiting of Goldwater when Hillary Clinton was a Goldwater girl. That's how she started political life. And the whole attack on Goldwater was he would have his finger on the nuclear button. He would be totally irrational and so forth. And then, of course, Lyndon Johnson, after defeating him, went on to escalate the whole war in Vietnam and get us into all sorts of madness. The same attacks were used against Ronald Reagan, who actually didn't get us into any hot wars comparable to our Democrats. It was used against Nixon, effectively, and then Nixon did the opening to China and actually negotiated the end of the Democrats' war in Vietnam. So it's an old trick. It fits Trump because he has his irrational basis. He's a right-wing. I've even called him a neo-fascist populist. He is quite dangerous. And so this gives Hillary Clinton a free ride in a way if she gets it. And there'll be no accountability to the progressive movement, whether it's on banking or on her very hawkish foreign policy. And her speech was devoid of any serious content about that. There was no mention of Libya. There was no mention of ISIS's origin in the Iraq war in an Iraqi-American prison camp. That's how it was hatched. There was no mention at all of the unintended consequence of regime change. And I think, you know, if Trump is and his advisors are the least bit smart about this, they'll carve out some opposition on this. After all, he didn't support the Iraq war, which created ISIS and this instability.
Bob, he did support the Iraq war.
If we define all of the progressive alternative on peace, and we rally around Hillary, it's really a victory for the neoconservative agenda. And by comparison, by the way, Kerry, as Secretary of State, has actually made serious advances using diplomacy that Hillary failed in every single case.
The thing there, and Joan is right, that Donald Trump made supportive statements about the Iraq war in the early phases. He came around and decided that he was against it at some point, arguably earlier than various other people figured that out. But he likes to talk about himself as having been an opponent of the war from the start, which he was not. And I was interested today on Friday, we had Susan Sarandon making the claim that Hillary Clinton is more dangerous than Donald Trump. And it's sort of, you know, sort of a similar story to the one that Bob is laying out about, you know, the Hillary's history of escalations in various places, including Libya. But I'm just wondering if there's really going to be a significant number of people to whom that case is convincing.
I don't think there will be. I mean, I speak as somebody who has written repeatedly that although I've endorsed Hillary Clinton, I am concerned about her hawkishness. Her Iraq war vote probably cost her the nomination in 2008, and that was probably fair. But I think people who act, there are people on the left, unfortunately, who cherry pick Donald Trump's statements, his foreign policy statements, to make him out to be an isolationist, somebody who's very smart, who will not engage in regime change. And that's absolutely crazy, because there's no evidence. He goes back and forth on what he will and won't do. So if you're really interested in it, you can criticize Hillary Clinton. She does have a rather consistent bent toward intervention. We can have a debate on that. But she's a pretty consistent, you know what you're going to get. Anyone who supports Trump thinking they're going to get some restrained isolationist who will not engage in regime change and will also be an equal, even-handed arbiter of the Israeli-Palestinian conflict is crazy.
Can I dare say that is not the issue? We have a primary in New Jersey and California. And in California right now, Sanders is neck and neck with Clinton, and Trump is doing quite well. And the point is it going to be Sanders versus Trump or Hillary Clinton versus Trump? It's not over.
And
I'm arguing is that if there is not a strong pro-peace progressive vote, an issue made right up through the Democratic convention, there is no way of holding Hillary Clinton to a progressive position.
This Democratic primary campaign is going to be over in a week.
Yeah,
Bernie Sanders is not going to be seeking the Democratic nomination for president in a week. It's over all except for the voting, and in a few days it's going to be over, including the voting. And so this is why Hillary Clinton is giving a speech that acts like Bernie Sanders doesn't exist, because she is going to have to win over his voters in the context of a general election in which he is not on the ballot, and some of them may choose to vote for Jill Stein or to not vote, or some of them may even choose to vote for Donald Trump.
And I would also add, I hope there is a strong movement for peace in the platform discussions. I mean, I'm very happy as somebody who, yes, I support Hillary Clinton in this primary for lots of reasons we don't need to litigate here. I consider myself a progressive, and I'm really happy that there's a progressive majority on the platform committee. I'm happy with most of Senator Sanders' choices. I'm happy with Hillary Clinton's choices. I'm shocked that Debbie Wasserman Schultz appointed Barbara Lee, one of the great anti-war voices of the Democratic Party. So I think that it's possible that people like Bob can get some people like me to support some progressive platform planks, but not if they treat us like idiots and say that we're passionate and don't understand things.
I want to ask Rich about one sort of related matter, which is as you know, as people on the left are deciding whether or not they can get comfortable with Hillary, you have all these people on the right deciding exactly how comfortable they can get with Trump. And we had this endorsement from Paul Ryan this week, placed in his hometown paper in Janesville, Wisconsin, released during Hillary Clinton's foreign policy speech, all things done, indicating that Ryan was basically trying to draw as little attention as possible to getting in line with Trump. And the thing I'm wondering is that basically, you know, Ryan listed certain policy areas where he thinks he can work productively with Trump. A lot of conservatives talk about the importance of Supreme Court appointments and that they think Trump would make better ones than Hillary. But the stuff that was laid out in Hillary's speech about basically the unknown and unknowns and who knows what Trump might do, and he won't rule out various nuclear actions. And it sort of, it seems like there's a lot of stuff here where it wouldn't matter who was on the Supreme Court. If Donald Trump launches a nuclear weapon, it doesn't matter if he's put conservative justices on the court. And I'm wondering, why isn't that weighing more on people?
Well, that's just part of the Trump case that these endorsers, whether it's Marco Rubio a week or so ago saying he'd be delighted to make the case for Trump at the convention, or it's Paul Ryan this past week, can't really grapple with. Because on substance, yes, it makes sense. You know what you're going to get from Hillary Clinton. Certainly domestically, it will be significantly to the left and will be anathema to all Republicans. But the temperament issue is the thing that's much harder to address, right? And Marco Rubio's case against Trump in the primary was largely based around him being a fraud and a con artist and someone who couldn't be trusted as commander-in-chief. It's very hard to get your way around that. So they just basically evade it and pretend either they didn't say it in Rubio's case, or Paul Ryan just doesn't really address it as a major issue. And as far as the back and forth between Bob and Joan, I do think, you know, ideologically, Trump is a fairly consistent non-interventionist. At least it's pretty clear to me that's where his heart is and has been for decades. He's been more consistent on that than many, many other things. But temperamentally, you just don't know what he'll do because he's so thin-skinned, he's so vindictive, and that's really where you know, Hillary's case against him hit home in that speech, I think.
I just want to ask quickly, though, when you say they sort of evade those things about the nuclear codes and whatnot, I understand how they're doing that rhetorically, but I'm wondering what you think is going on inside Marco Rubio's own head. He doesn't worry that he might be part of the process of putting this man in a position where he would do terrible things to the world, setting aside how he can defend that rhetorically and what it means for the party. These people don't have trouble going to sleep at night when they think about what this could mean in terms of human lives.
I hate to say it, but the partisan pull is extremely strong and is stronger than all other considerations, apparently. And a lot of these guys are thinking about their own futures in the party and thinking of running in 2020. And that just trumps these other matters.
Well, on that depressing note, let us know what you think about the nuclear codes at kcrw.com/LRC on our Facebook page, or message our Twitter account. That's at LRCKCRW. Up ahead, Trump and the judge. You're listening to Left, Right, and Center.
Listen to Left, Right, and Center on demand from KCRW's smartphone apps, now for the iPhone, Android, and BlackBerry. And share your thoughts on today's show at kcrw.com/LRC.
This podcast is produced by nonprofit radio station KCRW. Support the podcasts you enjoy by donating at kcrw.com/join.
Back again with Left, Right, and Center. I'm Josh Barrow of Business Insider and MSNBC. On the left is Robert Scheer, editor-in-chief at TruthDig.com and host of the KCRW podcast Scheer Intelligence. On the right is Rich Lowry, editor of National Review, and Joan Walsh of The Nation magazine is also with us. So Donald Trump had a rally in San Jose, California on Thursday, which devolved into violence outside as multiple protesters assaulted rally attendees, and police seemed to have too thin a presence on the ground to really control the unrest in a way that they have been able to outside various other Trump rallies. As we discussed last week, a number of these protesters were waving Mexican flags, perhaps creating images that that play into to exactly the sense that Donald Trump is trying to create. And then there was an additional controversy surrounding Donald Trump and people of Mexican descent this week, which was the judge in the fraud case regarding Trump University. Donald Trump said he needed to recuse himself because it was a conflict of interest that he is of Mexican descent. The judge presiding over that case is not actually from Mexico, born in Indiana, but his parents are from Mexico. Rich, what do you see to be done about this? We've had the ritual condemnations of violence from the Clinton and Sanders campaigns, but it's not at all clear that these people on the street take orders from either Hillary Clinton or Bernie Sanders.
Well, I think it's up to the police, and these folks just need to be kept under control. And it's completely shameful that someone attending one of these rallies would be punched in the face leaving. And that's just profoundly wrong at every single level. And it's up to the police to establish order. It's quite simple.
So I have this terrible feeling that Donald Trump is getting exactly what he wants here, which is not to say that it excuses what the protesters who committed crimes did. Nobody should punch anybody. And I also think that flying a Mexican flag as part of a political protest on U.S. soil sends a bad message. But I've been sort of wondering, why is Donald Trump spending so much time campaigning in California, a state which he is never going to win, where he is more than 20 points down in the polls? And I think the answer is that it's a place where he thinks he can get unruly crowds of people flying Mexican flags and punching people outside of his rallies.
I agree. I mean, we saw that in Burlingame. We also saw him travel to Albuquerque, where similar things happen, although not nearly as violent as we saw last night. In part, because I think the police were prepared for it and did a much better job of keeping the anti-Trump people separate from the Trump supporters. I mean, on the one hand, I saw a rally in Phoenix where the Trump supporters really were goading peaceful protesters into confrontation. But that has not happened in Albuquerque, and that definitely didn't happen last night in San Jose. This is something that definitely benefits Trump, that, you know, he can play that old Nixonian law and order card. These images are going to be disturbing to a lot of people who might be inclined to think that Trump is the dangerous, crazy one. Suddenly they think the anti-Trump people might be worse.
Bob, am I right to see this as being related to sort of a breakdown in a liberal norm about the idea that you should listen to people with differing views? Much more often than we've seen this sort of violence, we've seen protesters trying to interrupt Trump rallies, prevent him from speaking. We see a broader movement on college campuses trying to exclude speakers with undesired points of view. This seems to me like a possible logical extension of the idea that certain viewpoints simply shouldn't be heard.
We have a majority of people in this country who have shown serious expressions of pain over the failure of the system to meet their needs on the right and the left. If they don't find an outlet in peaceful means, yes, they get angry. That's not justified. But the problem is, if this becomes a race only between Trump playing his faux populism, his xenophobia, and so forth, and Hillary Clinton defending the status quo, yeah, I think there's going to be a lot of angry people there. I hope they'll go for a third-party candidate, whether it's the Libertarian or Jill Stein, whom I would prefer, and find an outlet there. But you've got to have outlets.
Rich, what did you make of this judge story? Mitch McConnell was asked about it today, and all he had to say was that Donald Trump is a very unusual candidate. It seems weird in the context of the judiciary being one of the arguments from conservatives about why you should vote for Trump.
Yeah, the idea that a judge of Mexican descent should somehow be disqualified from hearing this case or any case because of his descent, it's really impossible to exaggerate how un-American that idea is. And it's an implicit concession by Trump that he's hostile to people of Mexican descent, and they're hostile to him back.
No,
and
the Hispanics love him.
Well, yeah, and on the other hand, yeah, the Hispanics love him, and he eats taco bowls, and he's going to win a lot of their votes. Mm-hmm. But it really is, it's just another low that he has scraped in this election.
So as I watched Donald Trump pick that, and he'd been complaining about this judge, but on Thursday after Hillary gave this speech, that was the first time he really made the explicit statement that the judge could not preside over him because he was too Mexican. Previously, he had said, I think he's Mexican. That's great. It's good to be Mexican, but he's unfair. This was where he first drew that connection. And I think part of what he's up to is that to the extent that this election is about whether Donald Trump is a bigot and about disputes between whites and non-whites, it allows Trump to rally a certain and large fraction of white voters to his side. Whereas if the election is about will Donald Trump start a nuclear war, or will he create a global economic crisis, things that are bad not for specific groups but for everyone, that provides a really broad argument for Hillary to make. I feel like this was an attempt at changing the subject. He'd rather us discuss whether he's a bigot and then appeal to voters who just feel like people worry too much about political correctness and that we talk about this too much.
Right. And then, yes, bring out their defensiveness of him, bring out his champions. But I also thought, and maybe this isn't intentional, but I just thought his whole demeanor yesterday was on the one hand kind of showing that maybe Paul Ryan did have him on some sort of leash while he was courting his endorsement. And then once Ryan delivered the endorsement, he became unhinged, because that speech last night was honestly one of his most insane. And again, this is why I'm angry at the violent protesters. They completely upstage coverage of how grievance laden that speech was. It was all about him. It was all about the Washington Post. It was about Barbara Rez. It was all about the people who have wronged him. His face was bright red. His voice was hoarse in the end from screaming about how he's been wronged by the Republican Party, the media, women that he's given jobs to. It was really, I watched the whole thing and expected it to get much more of a reaction than it did.
Bob, you talk about people being angry and needing an outlet for that. And one of the things I worry about is that while there's this general sense of anger in the country and lots of people are discontented, the people do not necessarily have any consensus about what exactly they're angry about and what they'd like done about it. In fact, you have a lot of people to the left and to the right who have diametrically opposed preferences about what should be done to change the status quo. And when I look at what's happened in Europe, in countries where more extreme parties have either come to power, as in Greece, or have gotten an increased voice in government, is that I haven't seen people getting more contented as that has happened. Do you have a vision of what a less angry America would look like in which these questions are answered? What would bring unity about?
What would bring unity is what always brought unity to this country, was inclusion, and making it not just an aspiration. You can win the lottery and get ahead, but that if you work hard and you try to succeed, that there's an opportunity. And that has been taken away from people. We cannot discuss this Trump phenomenon in isolation, or Sanders for that matter. People are turning out to two improbable candidates on the Republican side. We're not going to suddenly decide that the Republican voters are crazy or narrow-minded or bigoted or anything else. I know Rich doesn't feel that way. We used to respect the Republican base and Republican voters. We certainly can't say that in the state of California, 50% or something close to it reject the anointed candidate of the party establishment, Hillary Clinton, and prefer a candidate who tells them we have major income inequality, major problems with our economy. You can't throw away that message. That's why I think the message should be delivered loud and clear. And what you're seeing is really the failure of the center. This whole discussion proceeds as if the center has done its job. Things are sort of working out well. And why is the American public so crazy? The American public is not crazy. The American public is frustrated. They don't think things are working for them. That's why 70% of new voters, Democratic voters, say they prefer Bernie Sanders, because they don't think life is promising for them in a way it should be. If you want solutions, yes, there are real solutions that both Hillary and Trump have rejected, which is break up the big banks. Yes, give a break on trade deals to average workers. Yes, improve the social safety net. And those can be presented in ways that are appealing to Republicans as well as Democrats. And you're going to hear some of that from both the Libertarian candidate and from the Green candidate, Jill Stein.
Joan, what do you see as putting at least the Democratic coalition back together? Certainly Hillary Clinton has had much less support than she expected 9 months ago. What would she do to make people in the party less discontented once she's nominated?
I think Bob's right to a degree that she has not captured, she has not gotten the extent of pain and dispossession that's out there. I think he's wrong to say that, you know, I think that her financial bank's plan is widely praised by left economists. It's better than I think he gives it credit for, but I don't think she's talking about it in the language of, in her plan, you know, bankers who break the law will go to jail. She doesn't say that. She doesn't go out and talk about that. I think debt-free college is very different from free college, and I, you know, that's a longer debate, but certainly I don't think that her campaign has really understood the level of angst around student debt and grappled with something really profound. And you know, I would love to see her collaborate with Senator Sanders on a real answer to student debt, not just talking about what to do going forward with future college students, but what to do with this mound of debt that this current generation lives with. So I think she's going to have to assimilate that. But I also think, you know, Bob is a little bit wrong in the sense that I think the center of gravity in the party has moved to the left, not because these are wonderful people or they do the right thing, but because the center of energy has moved to the left. I think 5 years ago, we were debating a grand bargain where Barack Obama was prepared to cut Social Security. And yesterday, the day before, I've lost track, he came out to expand Social Security. And I think that's because the left wing of the party announced that that was unacceptable and that the left is where the energy is. So, you know, I would hate to see people take that energy out of the Democratic Party, but that's their right.
Well, we've reached that time once again for our famed Left, Right, and Center rants featuring pet peeves from across the political spectrum. Rich Lowry, it's your soapbox.
Baylor University fired its football coach and demoted its president when it emerged that the school had dismissed sexual assault cases to protect its football program. Now, college football is highly entertaining. It's very lucrative, but it's not the highest good in education, and that an explicitly religious institution like Baylor doesn't get that is deeply dismaying.
Bob Scheer.
The pain that people are feeling out there on both sides, left and right, is the pain of an economy ravaged since 1992, when Bill Clinton came in and did radical economic deregulation, opened the floodgates of greed, allowed the merger investment in commercial banks, the packaging of lousy mortgages, and selling them to the worldwide population. The result has been great immiseration, and Democrats bear major responsibility for that.
John Walsh.
I would like more Republican voters to know that Paul and other voters to know that Paul Ryan met with Muslims in his district yesterday morning before he issued his endorsement or qualified or said he would go vote for a man who plans a Muslim ban. I really think that Paul Ryan is going to have a lot to answer for when this election is over.
For my rant, I want to stick up a little bit for the center and the status quo. The unemployment rate in the United States right now is 4.7%. Yes, this has been a grindingly slow and unpleasant economic recovery. Not enough people are able to afford to buy their own homes. Wages have not been rising fast enough. Things could be much better in the United States, but they could also be much worse. And that, I think, is the key question to look at Donald Trump in this election. You can think about all the terrible things that he probably won't do, but he might, and what that could mean for you and your family and your economic fortunes and your life. And it's a really scary proposition. Even when it feels like there are so many things we would like to have that we cannot grasp, we also have so much to lose, and people need to think about how much they have to lose. That's all we have time for today. I want to thank Robert Scheer, Rich Lowry, and Joan Walsh. Laura Dine-Million produced today's program. Our technical director is JC Swadek. Ashleen Knutson is our production assistant. I'm Josh Barrow. Thanks for joining us, and tune in next week for more Left, Right, and Center.
So if you like pajamas,
nice pajamas,
I'll wear pajamas.
You got pajamas.
Well, we know we
need each other, so we better call the calling of all. Let's go.
Download the podcast from KCRW.com or from iTunes and share your comments at KCRW.com/LRC. Left, Right, and Center is produced and distributed by KCRW.